Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now, the former Labor Secretary from the Clinton administration, Robert Reich. Very timely, with the biggest tax overhaul in decades now up for debate in Congress, and with an economic nationalist as president. So what does this liberal icon think it really means for American workers who did or did not vote for Donald Trump? Reich's 2015 book, Saving Capitalism, written before the election, has been made into a film of the same name, directed by Jacob Kornbluth. From the film, almost incredibly, here is archive footage of Robert Reich in 1994, pretty much predicting the ugly underbelly of resentment and hate that motivates some of Trump's most diehard supporters today. Again, this is from 23 years ago, 1994.
My friends, we are on the way to becoming a two-tiered society, composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind, whose anger and whose disillusionment is easily manipulated. Once unbottled, mass resentment can poison the very fabric of society, the moral integrity of a society, replacing ambition with envy, replacing tolerance with hate. Today, the targets of that rage are immigrants and welfare mothers and government officials and gays and an ill-defined counterculture. But as the middle class continues to erode, who will be the targets tomorrow?
Robert Reich from 1994, made current again by the new movie of his book, Saving Capitalism. Secretary Reich, congratulations on the film. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, hello, Brian. I'm hearing those words. I tell you, I don't take any pleasure in seeing the future in that way.
What was happening in 1994 that made you say those things?
Well, we began to see widening inequality of a sort that we hadn't seen in this country before. It started in the late 70s, but by the early 90s, most economists, most analysts had concluded that this was not simply an aberration. It really was something that was a structural change in the economy, a structural change that resembled, if anything, what happened in the era called the Gilded Age, where the robber barons, the 1880s, 1890s. The fear I had at that time, and I wasn't alone, I'm sure, is that if we allowed that inequality to continue to widen, not just income but also wealth inequality, it would become political inequality as well. The game would seem to be rigged to millions of people. It would be rigged, and that anger could be used for demagogic purposes.
What made you think that the decline of the white middle class would be taken out on poor people of color and immigrants who generally have less power than the white middle class, rather than on the corporate leaders who have more power?
I think the fact of the matter is that the anger is usually directed at outsiders, at people who are quote-unquote them, for exactly the reason you stated, Brian, because they don't have very much power. They don't have power to fight back. They don't have command over the airwaves. They don't have command, posses of public relations people and lawyers, and they can't manage the news. They really are the most vulnerable people in our society or outside our society, and their vulnerability makes them easy targets, easy scapegoats.
And your director, Jacob Kornbluth, says this is a movie about power, not politics. What's the difference in this case?
Well, I think that the difference is that when you move into a realm such as we're now in, where a lot of people in the United States feel that they are powerless, weak, vulnerable, that they are, in a sense, the... the people who are getting not just a bad deal, but are the recipients of a rigged game. We're no longer in a normal political situation. It's no longer Democrats versus Republicans. It really is about power. It's about the anti-establishment versus the establishment. And I think what's happened to American politics, certainly in the last, since the Wall Street crisis of 2008, is that you have two deep-seated anti-establishment currents. One started off as the Tea Party movement. It was very much against Wall Street, but it was also against government. It was against the collusion between government and Wall Street. The other, briefly, was the Occupy movement, which had a lot of overlap with the Tea Party movement in the sense that the Occupy movement was also a reaction against big government getting together with Wall Street and colluding against the rest of us. Those two anti-establishment movements then created ultimately Donald Trump. That he's on the right, the authoritarian aspect of anti-establishmentarianism, and on the left, you had Bernie Sanders, the kind of progressive side of the anti-establishment movement. And I think that anybody who thinks today that the major battle in American politics is between the left and the right, between the traditional left, the traditional right, between Democrats and Republicans, hasn't been watching, hasn't been listening. Mm-hmm. The real battle is between authoritarian populists like Trump, like Bannon and their ilk, on the one hand, and progressive populists, symbolized by Bernie Sanders, on the other side.
And it's it's so weird, in a way, at least from a progressive standpoint, that an anti-establishment movement would become authoritarianism, because what's the establishment? It's those in power with too much power and lack of responsiveness to democracy. So you would think that an anti-establishment movement would almost, by definition, be against authoritarianism, but that's not what's happening.
No. Well, historically, we've seen anti-establishment movements that have become very authoritarian. You just look at the history of the 20s and 30s in Europe. But I think also Donald Trump ran as an anti-establishment figure. He kept saying to people in more, in different ways, but kept saying that, I'm a strong man. I am powerful enough. I am rich enough. I am, I will be your voice, which is the classic, at least classic in the modern era, strongman populist pitch to people who feel that they have been wronged by elites.
My guest is former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. His 2015 book, Saving Capitalism, has now been made into a movie of the same name. Here's another clip from the film. It's a guy challenging some of your economic worldview at a lunch meeting you had with Kansas City Republicans.
And let's talk about power. Let's talk about my two clients who started a company 20 years ago and are now billionaires. They employ 9,000 people. They pay hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes. They pay high wages. It's a high-tech company, value-added, generous benefits, and yet they're held up to scorn and hatred and ridicule and contempt because they've added to income inequality, added to the concentration of wealth, added to disparity. Why are they the scapegoat? They're enacting the American dream. One of them is an immigrant.
What's your response to that guy?
In much of the film, I did travel to red states talking to people, business people, and working class people and poor people, to try to explore what they were thinking about in 2015 leading up to the election, and presumably what they're still thinking about. That particular businessman was obviously angry with me because he thought that I had been demonizing the rich for being rich and adding to inequality. And I explained to him that I wasn't at all, that he... I appreciated, and I'm sure millions of Americans appreciated the jobs and innovations that many wealthy people have been responsible for. The problem was that was with the abuse of power in terms of turning that wealth into political power that added to their wealth later on by rigging the rules of the game. And that abuse of power was the ultimate behavior that I certainly was criticizing, not somebody simply because they were rich.
Why can't there be more common ground between working class white people and working class people of color? I mean, if we learned anything from the last election, I guess we relearned that in American politics, race trumps class in terms of white resentment. You think?
Well, I think you're asking exactly the right question, Brian. And I think that ultimately, if there is going to be any advance for the bottom, let's say the bottom 60% or 70% of Americans who are stuck, you know, whose wages have not advanced at all, adjusted for inflation, over 40 years, and who are falling behind the rest of America, and who really have reason to believe that the game is rigged against them. The only political possibility they have to gain political strength is if they join together. And we're talking about blacks and whites and Latinos who are poor and working class and lower middle class. It has got to be a multiracial, multiethnic coalition that basically takes... power back in terms of the economy. And one very, very basic point that I made in the book and we make in the movie is that you can't separate politics from economics. I mean, you know, or markets from government. I mean, government and politics are continuously setting the rules of the game. And if the game is rigged against the bottom 60%, it's because government and political forces have done that rigging, and that's exactly what's happened.
Former Labor Secretary Robert Rice with us. The new film, Saving Capitalism, is based on his book of the same name. Here's a clip from the film of Bill Clinton in 1991. Secretary Rice was Labor Secretary under Bill Clinton. So Clinton's not even been elected yet in this clip. He's running for president, and he raises the issue of CEO pay.
The average CEO at a major American corporation, according to a recent Senate hearing, is paid about 100 times as much as the average worker. And our government today rewards that excess with a tax break for executive pay, no matter how high it is. That's wrong. If companies want to overpay their executives and underinvest in their future, that's their business. But they shouldn't get any special treatment from Uncle Sam.
So, Secretary Rice, what was the issue there about tax incentives for excessive CEO pay?
Well, Bill Clinton and that election recommended that companies not be able to deduct executive pay over $1 million. They could reward their executives over $1 million, but they couldn't deduct it from their corporate taxes. That proposal it ultimately found its way into a rule that was not exactly the same as the proposal. The rule said that companies can deduct executive pay in excess of $1 million if the pay itself is connected to performance, that is, stocks and stock options. Well, from that date, stocks and stock options for executives took off. I mean, that's one reason today's executives are paid not 100 times the average worker, as was the case in 1991. But today, with big companies, it's about 300 times the average worker.
So when Clinton became president, they did pass a bill, but with a giant loophole. Is that what you're saying?
A giant loophole. It sounded good. That is, you know, companies could not deduct executive pay over $1 million. But the loophole was, unless the companies linked it to company performance, the share value, the stock market. Well, that was a loophole in which, you know, an entire, almost an entire generation of executives has trampled through and made gigantic amounts of money.
So one could argue that by that measure, a CEO's pay is a reflection of their value to the company in the marketplace. What would you say about that?
Well, the market, remember the stock market, beginning in the 90s, took a gigantic leap upward. I mean, you know, an typical executive of a big company could have gone into his or her office and played solitaire for 10 years, and, you know, the company's stock would still have leapt upwards because the entire Dow Jones Industrial Average went up at a huge pace. They had nothing to do with CEO effort. And yet, because their pay was linked to stock performance by stock options and by stock grants, they got a huge, huge windfall.
So what do we do about that winner-take-all distribution as a society? If we've gone up from CEO pay to average worker pay 100 to 1 in the 1990s to, what did you say, 300 to 1?
For large companies, it's 300 to 1. The typical CEO today is earning, of a big company, is earning about $20 million a year. And that's true of even CEOs who presided over bad companies. I mean, whose company stocks have actually declined. You look at GE, Jeff Immelt. He's going to be retiring at the end of the year. You know, in 2001, he started, and GE's stock price has declined about 30%. And yet he's done extremely well, about $20 million a year, and he's going to retire with about $250 million in total. There's no relationship between executive pay and company performance any longer. Even though the pay is linked to stock prices, what the compensation committees do is they just give executives more and more stock, even if the stock price is going down. Well, you just get more and more of it, so you get up to the equivalent of $20 million a year. What do we do about all this? Look, Brian, I think that we've got to raise taxes on the income and wealth of people at the top who've never been as wealthy. You know, the wealthiest Americans now have a much greater chunk of Americans. The top 1% in wealth owns about almost 40% of the entire wealth of the nation. We haven't seen this since the era of the robber barons, the Gilded Age of the 1880s, 1890s. We've got to tax wealth. We've got to go in the opposite direction that Donald Trump and Republicans want to go in.
I haven't seen the full film yet. I've seen excerpts. But the press materials say you have found common ground with Republican Congressman Dave Brat of Virginia. Now, if I'm not mistaken, he was the Tea Party guy who successfully primaried Majority Leader Eric Cantor from Virginia, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And I went to talk to him. And in the film, we discover that we see eye to eye on economic issues, on social issues. We might as well be on different planets. But on economic issues, he feels that the game is rigged exactly as I do by big money. And both of us want to get big money out of politics. Both of us. And in fact, he sounded exactly like Bernie Sanders. He kept on talking about the consequences of big money creating crony capitalism. Well, I think there is in that overlap some possible political coalition, let's call it, of a sort that we were talking about before, at least to the extent that we try to unrig the system, get big money out of politics. That's got to be the prerequisite for doing everything else.
The common ground is described as being anti-crony capitalism in the film and by you just now. But I wonder about that. Conservatives point to things that they say are crony capitalism because they don't want government picking winners and losers based on the politicians' interests. And that's okay as far as it goes. But I tend to think the bigger form of crony capitalism is a libertarian do-nothing government, because the more unregulated an economy is, the more it's going to tend to let power concentrate, and then workers and consumers and the environment will all suffer. What's your view?
Well, I don't think there's such thing as a deregulated economy. I think that's a a complete falsehood. We thought we were deregulating Wall Street, and actually we bailed out. We ended up bailing out Wall Street, which was the most intense form of government intrusion. And now we have another form of regulation over Wall Street. There's no such thing as a market without government setting the rules of the game. And I think that the real issue is not government or market. The real issue is who sets the rules of the game and how do you get big money out of the business of setting the rules of the game. And that's why crony capitalism is an important term here, but there are many other terms as well. I think the goal has got to be to make sure that the wealthiest and largest players, whether they be corporations or individuals, are not permitted to rig the game, stack the deck in ways that enrich themselves but harm everybody else. And that's exactly what's been going on.
We have a few minutes left with former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. The new movie based on his book is called Saving Capitalism. Some things from the news briefly, if we can. Trump's statement in Asia that China should be looking out for Chinese workers first. Just as America first means our government looks out for our workers first, therefore he doesn't blame China for getting over on us in the past, and that's the basis of his economic nationalism. It almost sounds like common sense when he puts it that way. Every country looks out for its own workers first. Do you have an opinion about this?
It sounds like common sense. The problem, Brian, is that you very easily get into a kind of what used to be called beggar thy neighbor system, in which by looking out for your own people, you are taking advantage of others around the world. Instead of viewing the world economy as a potential positive sum game in which everybody can come out to some extent a winner, you view the world economy as a zero sum game in which one nation, like the United States, gains only to the extent that another nation, like China, loses. That is a perversion of what we know about economics and about global economics, and it's very dangerous because it could lead to some policies, some very nationalistic and isolationist policies that are ultimately bad for everybody.
Well, Trump pulled us out of the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Trade Deal, TPP. Bernie Sanders would have too, so both strands, the progressive and the regressive populism, the other 11 countries are now forming their free trade zone without us. I'm curious for your perspective as a progressive economist, will American workers be better off or worse off because of this decision?
Well, American workers, in my view, are better off without the TPP because inside the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a very draconian provision that would have allowed any company, any global company, to go to a tribunal outside the courts of the United States and get compensated by the United States for any health or safety or environmental regulation that caused that company to lose money. I mean, that, you know, that would be a huge imposition. It would make it more difficult for us or any signatory to the TPP to enact health, safety, or environmental regulations. I was against it because of that. And to the extent that that's still in the TPP, it's still dangerous for workers who live in those nations that will be signing up for it.
And last thing, the tax bill. They're trying to sell this as not just another trickle-down tax cut for the rich, like under Reagan or George W. Bush, but a more profound restructuring of the tax system to make it make more sense, as well as provide better incentives for growth. Do you see some complexity, at least, there?
Well, certainly there's more complexity there than they had been talking about. I mean, the Senate bill has more brackets, more tax brackets, but there are also complexities with regard to deductions, what you can deduct, what you can't deduct. The basic point, Brian, I've looked at that tax bill, both tax bills, the House bill and the Senate bill, and they are both premised on the same supply-side trickle-down economics. They're giving huge breaks, tax breaks to the wealthy. They're not giving huge tax breaks to the middle class. In fact, some middle-class people are going to be ending up paying more. It's a fraud. It's a hoax. It is the same supply-side economics that generated a gigantic deficit after the Reagan and first Bush years, and after the second Bush years got us into trouble economically. Why we're doing this again, particularly when big corporations have more money than they know what to do with, and the rich in America also are richer than they've ever been in the history of the United States or the history of the world, why they need tax breaks is beyond, is just beyond imagination.
Well, the argument that I think even many Democrats buy is that corporate taxes in particular should go down because we're high compared to other countries we compete with. Is that wrong?
That's simply not true. You look at the effective tax rate, what big companies are actually paying, and we're paying about the same rate as most other nations. The other point is that big companies in America, you know, if they pay less tax than they're now paying, if our tax rate drops, you can bet that other companies are going to drop their tax rates to be competitive with us. Another example of just beggar thy neighbor, you know, the a zero-sum game. It would make some sense if American companies were having difficulty competing internationally. There is no evidence that that's the case.
The one thing that's really controversial around here, the New York, New Jersey area, with our relatively high state and local taxes, is that state and local taxes would no longer be federally tax deductible. Even some Republicans from the New York and New Jersey delegation will vote no on this bill just based on that being in there. But why should low local tax states like New Hampshire, say, have to subsidize our decision in New York and New Jersey to impose high local taxes?
Well, first of all, it's California as well. Let's not leave out California. They're all Democratic states that the Republican Congress and Donald Trump are penalizing or want to penalize by basically saying you can't deduct state and local taxes anymore. The basic reality is that California, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, all of these Democratic states have been subsidizing Republican states for years. We send in much more to the federal government than we get back from the federal government. The Republican states, red states, are sending far less in income taxes than they get back from the federal government. So, you know, if you want to play the why should they or we subsidize game, ultimately you're back to the question of, you know, why should Democratic states subsidize Republican states?
Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, his book, Saving Capitalism, is now a movie, and it premieres on Netflix next Tuesday, November 21st. Secretary Reich, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Brian.